We have to be very quiet.
Oh, no, not at all. I'm here. I'm here in Kilcullen, and I'm with Nessa Dunley, who has brought me into Pat Lynch's house, and I'm talking to Pat. Beside his lovely burning fire, my God, the coal and the logs. And I don't see any turf, and there's loads of bogs in this area, isn't there?
There are loads of them, yes, but we are kind of West Kildare, while the bogs are east, while the bogs are more easterly. While there's a lot of turf available in that area, but not so much over here, you know, unless you picked it off the paper, you wouldn't get it, you know.
But did people do well out of Bordnamona and the bogs and that in this area?
Oh, not this area, not so much this area, but across from Rattangan, Monsterevin, Allenwood, all that area, Carberry particularly, around that area.
Would people have gone from here over there, you know, doing seasonal work and that?
No, not so much. It was more localized. But during the war, when we came to live in Kilcullen here in 1940, which was, as you know, the things were very bad, scarce, and we used to go from here to Suncroft. That time you would go to Suncroft and you would buy a perch of turf and you would cut it during the summer holidays and you would bring it home. It was an arduous kind of a job because there was no great transport and there wouldn't be any great lorries or tractor or trailers at that time. So we used to cycle from here to Suncroft, particularly during the summertime. That's where you spent your summer holidays. And then, of course, it had to be you would have to draw it out to the side of the road because the lorry couldn't or the tractor couldn't get in the bog, and then it had to be brought home to school, and then it had to be stored in a shed, and it was a very long protracted kind of an effort and that's why during the war this area used to depend on turf a lot and timber.
And were those happy days that you worked in the bog? or were they hard days?
Well, they were hard days, and hard days. We'd leave here early in the morning, the summer morning, to cycle, and you're talking about 10, 12 miles maybe, you know. And then you would have to hire a turf cutter. Like, it was not everyone just cut turf. There were specialist men in that area. And depending on, you could get a very hard taskmaster, the guards cutting the turf. And I, as a young lad, maybe 15 or 16, and you would have to wheel the turf. It was this big barrow with a big wooden wheel, and you would have to catch the turf, lay it on the barrow, and wheel it out to the spreading ground, which wasn't a very nice job, particularly a young lad of 15 or 16. And that went on for the best part, maybe a week, maybe a fortnight, depending on the weather. You know, and then you kind of more or less you slept and you wet, and the people would come in the middle of the day and the tea would be made on the turf fire. And I often remember my sister, God have mercy on her, she used to come out one of the days we were there, she used to play an accordion while we were having the tea. She would play the music for us there, and the midgets, or the pismires as they used to call them at that, would be eating the sandwiches as well as your own.
And would you sell the turf, or would you
solely for our own use?
And how did you transport it back then?
Well, it depended on, there was a local haulier, Tommy Orford, and he was the only lorry man around here who would have a license, and you would have to depend on whether he was free or when he was free, and when he was free, then we would go and we would load up the turf, all by hand incidentally, into the lorry, bring it home, offload it down. We lived down the bottom of the town. You'd offload it there, bring it down with a wheelbarrow out to your shed out the back.
And where did you grow up now, tell me?
I was born and reared on the Curragh. My father was a soldier in the army.
You're Curragh Camp?
Curragh Camp, yes. And I went to school at the Curragh Camp. And we were there until 1940. That was after the outbreak of war in 1939. And all the barracks in the Curraghmarry quarter, we were all evacuated. And with the case of where you could get accommodation on and around Newbridge, Naas, Kildare, Suncroft, Kilcullen, wherever you could get accommodation. And we were, I suppose, fortunate or unfortunate, we selected Kilcullen we got a house down the town.
We were very fortunate.
But your father and your mother, your mother's maiden name was?
Beatrice.
And idea how your father met your mother?
Well, they were from Dublin originally, see. My father spent his time in what was the Walden Water Company in what particular street, I don't know, you don't know about the rotunda there. He was a mechanic there anyhow, and then he joined the army at 17, and he married my mother then in Dublin. And in 1923, he was commissioned to come to the Curragh to set up workshops on the Curragh.
That's interesting now, because your father, was he in the British Army before he was in the Irish Army?
My grandfather was in the British Army, but my father was in the regular Army, yes.
So soldiering was always in the family?
In the family, yes. Yes.
And your father, he joined the Irish Army after the forming of the Free State?
Yes, yes.
So he was, as they described him, Free Stater?
Free Stater, yes.
Was he involved in the Troubles?
He was not... As such, I don't know, this is kind of an interesting thing, that he was stationed in Dublin, and being a mechanic, he was in charge of a fleet of armoured Rolls-Royce, which one of them was the Slieve na Mon, which was Michael Collins's car that was used in the Bail na Blá shooting where Michael Collins was shot.
Isn't that interesting? Your father would have been involved in the... Mechanical side of that car.
Yes.
And servicing it.
Servicing
so
that car, that's right. And today that car is still under Curragh, and my father looked after it while his time in the army, and when he left, I took over the running of the car, and when I left, a son of mine, who is now, he's responsible for the upkeep of the car, which is still under Curragh. Had it been a bit earlier sometime during the day, I could have brought you up and you could have seen it.
So your family had a huge attachment to that car.
That car, yes. Yeah.
Mm. No, so you followed your father's footsteps as well into the army.
Yes, I was, funny thing, I joined the Army Air Corps as in Baldonnell, you know, as an apprentice in Baldonnell. And just coming towards the end of my training, it was discovered I was big into the football. Nessa would know that I was big into the football, but was one of those days I had a bit of a seizure, for the want of knowing a better word, wasn't it? But they discovered I had a murmur in my heart. So I was discharged from the army. And I wound up then as in Tintown, what was known years ago, and I was the cavalry workshops on the Curragh. I was there for over 40 years.
What was your brief? What were you doing?
Well, I was a mechanic, wound up as a mechanic.
And wound up
as foreman in the garage, yes.
So really following your father's footsteps.
That's true, yes.
Well, that's interesting how all that came about. So did you play senior or junior for the county?
Junior, and I've got a couple of runs on the senior team as well.
Did you? The White Lilies?
The White Lilies, and Nessa's father would have been instrumental in that. He was a big, very big man in the county board here, and he was, one of the prime movers in the GAA in Kilcullen, and his brother actually, Dr. Nan, who was instead too, that he was, when he was a student in college in Dublin,
College of Surgeons,
and he used to come home here on holidays, and this by back in the 30s, ones, twos and threes now, and he undertook to look after the team. And he trained the first of the club-winning championships in Kilcullen, 1943, Dr. Dan O'Connell. And Jim's, Nessa's father, he was on that team as well.
Was he?
See, I'm learning here as well. This is why I'm delighted that you're speaking to Pat, because there are things that I don't know, and I'm hearing them now, and I wasn't aware of that. But the Kilcullen, there was a very successful... At that particular time, wasn't it, Pat?
It was very successful in the 1916, and Nessa had three uncles on that. They won a championship in 1916, and Nessa had three uncles on that.
Yeah, this was the Nolans.
They were the Nolans, yes.
I was telling Morris about the Nolans, the Butchers, the fourth generation.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it would have been of that family. G, who ran the business after his father died, he was in it. And who was the captain of that particular team?
Andy, as in Gormastown. And there was Mike then, who had a pub in Naith. But the three brothers were on that.
So it must have been very disappointing for you to discover that you had this heart murmur that yeah. knocked you out of the...
The funny thing about it, they told me then that I had heart murmur, but I came home and I kind of convalesced and I played football and I boxed and I played handball and I played tennis up to quite recently there. I have two artificial knees, so I had to give up on that thing. I still do a lot of walking.
Well, yeah, so you had a very active life, really. And,
indeed, yes.
Tell me all about those, other sports here in Kilcullen that you would have been involved in, the boxing.
Mm-hmm.
Describe to me, where was it? Where was the boxing practiced?
The boxing, Nessa would know better. It started in, I think now, about 1940-41. There's a little cottage out the road there. It belongs to the Castle Martin estate. There were people by the name of Snells lived in it.
Right.
Snells.
On the Newbridge Road outside Kilcullen.
Kilcullen, just before, after the main gates into Castle Martin. And there, the father of those Snell people, he was the head butler in Colonel Blacker's estate at the time. He was the head waiter, head whatever. Was. But he had a son who was into the boxing, and we used to train out the back, a little cottage out the back of the house, and that was in the garden. There was no shed, there was no nothing, there was a kitchen. We used to go in the big kitchen, big table in the kitchen, and a huge big one of these old time farm tables, as you would mm-hmm. know. And we would go in there after, and funny thing about it, he used to train a few greyhounds, and was wire netting around the table, and the greyhounds were under the table, like, and we'd be talking boxing at the same time. I said, that's how it kind of started out there.
And then it
progressed. God, we were like the travelling people, because it progressed down. The next port of call was down where Ness's son has the furniture shop down the town. It used to be Burkitt's.
Coleman's, where you interviewed me, Morris.
That was a huge big kitchen there with a big flag floor in it, and big, there was nothing in it. So that's where we started. We kind of progressed up to that.
You went from the
Snells
to Coleman's, and then you went to the hideout, was it?
No, Nan Brennan's Hall. On the hill here, there's another place, that's just on the way up here, and that's to show you where to go down.
Yes.
It was known as Dan Brennan's Hall. That's where we trained for a long, long time there.
Was that an outside shed or something?
Yes, sort of
a cow shed?
Cow shed, it's just a little shed there.
Yes.
There as you get over the stile to go to the Green Hills.
Okay, and was there a snooker table in there as well?
That's where the famous... table moving table.
Was that a sort of a social hall that somebody started? Did Dan give it free of charge to the young people of
the community?
People.
And there were also dances, we used to have dances in it as well, apart from the boxing.
And who ran those dances?
Well, the GAA ran some of them, and the boxing lab ran them as,
Was that the main meeting place for young lads at the
right.
time?
That was the only place. That was the only place.
This before the town hall, Pat?
Oh, long before it.
So when are we talking about?
When are we talking? We're talking about the late 40s, early 50s.
Well, the town hall was built in the 1930s.
Yes, but that was solely for... Oh, there was a dance hall originally then, and then they decided that the Burns took it over and they put in the projector machines and showed films at it then at that stage. Yes.
So that's why... It wasn't a town hall, was sort of a cinema.
Cinema.
And the town hall, really, or the social club, was up in Dan Brennan's.
Dan Brennan's, the social side of it. And then... they say the hall, Dan Brennan's hall, wasn't big enough to hold boxing tournaments, so we used to hold them in the town hall. There was films three nights a week in the town hall, and then we used to be able to the night there would be no fill of, we would be able to organise a boxing tournament in the, in the town hall.
Well, isn't that fantastic, you know,
Where did you go after that, Pat?
From that, then we went to the hideout.
Yes.
To the hideout.
And that's where it really got serious now.
That's where it got really big then. Yes. And the hideout is the pub up there, and they had a big loft out the back, and we used to train there. And the funny thing about it was also used as an undertaker. They had an undertaker in business. And there was often nights we went up there to training, and you would have to move coffins out of the way and put them down to one end of the hall. Or some people would have been preparing a coffin for a funeral, you see, and they would leave all the bits and pieces around. So our job would, before you start training, you would have to move the coffins down to the back end of the hall.
So when did you build the John F. Kennedy Hall then, the boxing club?
When did we build it? 1950. When was Kennedy assassinated?
In 1960.
Yeah, 63. Around that time,
We were obliged to leave the loft, as we called Burns Loft. And Neff's uncle had a little plot of ground down behind Fallon's pub down there.
Yes.
And we bought this site off your Uncle Joe for £200. And
Where did you get that money?
Would you believe there was a gentleman farmer who lived, Mr. Ockehart. He was a big farm out there.
New Abbey Stud,
yes. And he put up most of the money for it. Then we went around begging and selling flags.
Yeah, like how all things are done, isn't it?
Yes,
yeah. You just go around and collect, yeah.
Tell me about kind of how your famous boxers that came out of that club.
I'd be very interested to know that now, you know.
We had an Olympian, Colin McKay, who was a cruiserweight, and he went to the semi-finals, and he was beaten by no other than the famous Muhammad Ali in the semi-final.
Of the Olympics, yes.
And he did his training here?
Yes.
This
was his home club, but he lived, would you believe, in a little village way up north Kildare, Kill, about 15, 20 miles from here, mm-hmm. near enough.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to cycle most nights himself, and a man by the name of Hugh Peacock, and another chap, Jimmy Bracken, who used to meet in Naas, and would cycle here, do the train, and cycle home.
Oh, that's interesting, and I'll be up in Kill now tomorrow, so I'm making inquiries about that.
If you ask for the McKay family, Colin McKay, yes?
Yeah.
One of his brothers is the main dealer on the near...
car dealer.
Now.
He won a bronze medal in the European Championship.
Because you
remember when he came home from that, Pat, didn't we have bonfires?
Bonfires on Dunbrennan's Hill, yes.
And everybody was a big parade down to the town.
There's a photograph in the town hall,
of this Colin McKay up on a big lorry.
A float
coming down to congratulate him and welcome him home after winning the bronze medal in the European Championship.
Yes,
and we had the big bonfires on the hill as we came up the hill there. That was all fields before the houses were there and it was a big bonfire. So that was, and then just Hugh Peacock, he was very successful.
Hugh Peacock was successful in junior. He never matured at the senior standards. He won a junior championship. But then we had another chap, and he had a peculiar name, a German, it'll come to me in a minute. But anyway,
What about soccer? Was that something?
No, soccer or rugby. They didn't appear until the late 60s, 70s or so.
And other games like...
There was handball and there was tennis just across the road here.
What about camogie and...
There was a little bit of camogie, not to a great extent, never won any great trophies. But there was a good bit of involvement in the camogie at the time. Tennis club, yes. Our little old tennis club over here was very successful. We never won any trophies. But it was used extensively, particularly during the summer, the hard course, and there was two soft courts, and then we had a little clubhouse. So
all of this was going on. You were working by daytime over in Currycamp in a garage.
Yes.
And The kind of trucks you were servicing at the time, the army wasn't hugely, I'd say there wasn't a huge amount of trucks there, was there?
It was, by virtue of the fact that it was called the cavalry workshops, which meant that was all cavalry material. Now, the cavalry, as distinct from the horses, was there was armoured cars and tanks and motorbikes and all that end, of the army. That was my end of it, maintenance of all that end of it.
So it was the army workshop. It wasn't a garage. Open to the public.
No, that's that I know, you know, that it was actually but now these were interesting times because you were facing into the slightly before your time, your dad's time, you had the emergency period, and during those years, was there a scare that there was going to be an invasion by the Germans?
There was a very imminent kind of a scare at that stage, because I remember back in the early 70s, we had what was called Landswehr armored cars, and they were the only kind of armored equipment we had at the time.
And this was inherited from the British?
No, these were Germans. They were bought by the army before.
Were they?
Before, yeah, in the late 30s. They came in the late 30s, those Landswehr armour cars. And they were being deployed to Finnair Camp. That's the way up in Donegal. You know, those were being sent to Finnair Camp. And on the way to Finnair Camp, one of them broke down as in Boyle in the county of Roscommon. And I was sent up myself and a crew, we were sent up to recover this armoured car. But on our way back, we went into the barracks in Athlone, where we went in for some refreshments. But the Athlone barracks on that particular night was full to the jaws of Irish soldiers, all in battle dress and ready to move. Waiting for a phone call to move, which never materialised, of course, but they were that near to going in at that time.
What year was that? 1940?
That had been 40. It'd been 19. Let me think now.
It'd been the
60s, wasn't it? 60, 69 was the troubles.
Sorry, you were in a different time. I'll just stop a second.
We would call it.
I was talking about the emergency time, but you were talking about the troubles in the north. Yeah. But staying with that first, because that's also very interesting. There was a genuine scare there was going to be trouble, real trouble in the north.
There was only a matter of a phone call, because the night we called into Athlone on our way back after recovering this armoured car, we called in there for something to eat, and they were all at the ready. They were all just all on high alert, waiting for a phone call to move.
Right. Yeah. And the I suppose you witnessed all of this, and you were there. How were lads? I mean, were lads worried and nervous about it?
We're all keyed up for it, you know. And
they were going to quite prepared to go into the north of Ireland.
We're there, absolutely ready for a phone call, as I said. I'm repeating myself there now. Waiting for a phone call, because this convoy of armoured cars that had been sent up to Finnair, which is just on the border up there in Donegal, you know, that they were to be there to move in.
So all these strategic moves were taking place as well. The movement of armoured cars
and all the troops being stationed in Athlone Barracks, which was the main barracks up that.
And how many troops would have been there roughly?
Roughly there could have been 2,000 or 3,000 maybe. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. And the at the ready.
At the ready, ready, all armed and all kitted out, ready to move.
Yeah, and tensions were high, were they?
Oh, sure, hyper. Yes, hyper. You could imagine all those people all sitting around there with their rifle and their bayonets, and well, they wouldn't have flak jackets as they have now, but they were in their wool uniform, ready to go, and with their kit bags and on their backs.
What kind of chance would they have had? I mean,
none. not at all. We would never. We would have never been able, because we hadn't at the first place. Those old armored cars that were gone well by their sell-by date, you know, and they was had a chore getting there, and that was the only bit of armor they would had. Like, there was no aircraft, there was no backup. It would have been all foot soldiers that we were moving in at that time. That was all.
And your position as a mechanic, you were just looking after the trucks, and you were on your way back to Curry Camp again.
Yes.
Yeah,
on the way back.
And what was going on in Curry Camp at the time? Was it obviously much quieter?
Much quieter, because all the movement had been from the Curry to these outposts along the border.
To have them ready up along the way.
The border, yes,
were there any prisoners in the Curry at that time?
There would have been no prisoners. The prisoners came after that, like McStephon and those guys. They were all interred on the Curry after that.
That made a big difference to families living in the Curry, didn't it? You know, you were...
Well, it made a huge difference, you know, because it broke up communities completely. You know, the Curry was a town in itself. Like, they had all kinds of shops and stores and... everything that
and from that point
needed.
It all kind of changed.
Yeah, it the whole thing fractured, because I say we came to Kilcullen, a lot of our friends went to Naas, Newbridge, Suncroft, Atai, all around the country. You know, people all just disappeared off the radar, as they would say.
Yeah, you spoke about being, it was your family was living in the Curry.
We were living in married quarters. Yeah. There were nine in our family. Yes.
Was it? Yeah, nine of you.
Nine
and
of us.
Where did you come in?
I was there was six girls and there was three boys, and I was the fourth. I was the first boy after three girls.
Were you the only one to kind of follow your father's footsteps? Any of your other siblings get involved?
No, not directly. My next brother, Morris, he joined the British Air Force, but that was after the war, you know. But other than that, I had a priest then went into religion. He's still alive.
No.
He's ministering down in Galway, in a little parish named Tiernasca down in Galway at the moment. He went to the missions.
Yeah, and so kind of the it's interesting to note how they all stayed around, though. You know, they didn't emigrate.
No, my youngest sister Etna, she was into the hairdressing, and she went to England back in the 70s or thereaway, you know. And two of my sisters are in Dublin, and there's two of them dead, and my sister of mine lives just down the road here. So
And how long did you stay in the business of the mechanical business?
Until retiring age, yes, 65.
So you didn't do anything, really, you stayed with that? You still
stayed
with it,
with that, yes.
The change in machinery, or in the different kinds of vesicles that the army would have had, you would have seen a kind of a growth in the quality and the...
Oh, a huge growth in because up to that time, up to that in the 40s, when those Landsberg armour cars, they were the only thing of note that they had. But incidentally, as a result of that, they got into Ford armour cars, who were manufactured in Carlow. I can't think of the garage now at the moment. But anyway, that they made armour cars and put them on Ford chassis. And those were the ones that were sent to the Congo. Those Ford armor cars were sent to the
Congo. That's interesting.
A far
cry from the Crosley tender.
Oh, the Crosley tender and the old Rolls Royces. Now, there was 13 of those, and 13 of those were on the Curra. And as I say, when they came to the point that they were of no further use in service, they were all scrapped. And the only one that was left was to sleeve them on.
No, Pat, I'm going to bring you, because I'm very interested in the emergency period, because during the Second World War, the Curra Camp soldiers, there was many contracts put out, a contract to deliver turf to different areas, different places. Do you remember anything about contract work?
Well, I remember, not so much the contract, but I know that the army lorries were used to who ferry the Turk from Lullymore, that would be off over under its hanging monster in that area. And they were used extensively then to bring the turf to the Curragh and the barracks system. As a matter of fact, in that time there was huge ricks of turf made in the Phoenix Park, which was to supply the greater part of Dublin. And they were there for years and years after. I'm sure the remnants are somewhere around there. But the army, they were deployed to transport this turf to the various centres around.
And while all of that was happening, you were keeping some of the Republican prisoners in Curragh Camp as well.
Yes, yeah.
Do you remember that time?
Well, I do. I remember, apart from the internment camp, or Hare Park as it is known, it was first used for a lot of the German and British Army planes that crashed. They were all brought, anyone that survived, they were interred on the Curragh, yes, during the war. And so also then afterwards, then all the IRA that were rounded up, and they were kept then in the same place as those German prisoners.
A lot of them came up from Kerry, actually.
Kerry, yes.
And, you know, southern counties. Yeah. And were these, you know, did were you close to them? Did you get, were you allowed?
Would you talk to them? No, not so much the Republican prisoners, but the Germans now, and the Germans more than the British. The Germans integrated a lot. They were
allowed out.
They were allowed out, you see. And any of them that had a trade, like, you know, whatever, a fitter, a mechanic, a butcher, whatever, if they could find employment around, which a lot of them did, even farm labourers. So a lot of the Germans employed around there and married Irish girls as well. But as regards
were the local lads doing, the Irish Republican prisoners?
Oh, they were all interred. They weren't allowed out at all.
Were they not?
Oh, no, they were under heavy guard. All
was there any escape attempt?
Oh, several, yes. Oh, several. They burnt down. I remember one particular time there was an army officer, Guineas, from the Linden Brigade Lodge. You know them. One of the Guineas had a shop in New Britannia. There was an incident that they set fire to a lot of the huts, and I remember it was on a Saturday, and all, like my father and all the people around, were all called in. You know. But there was this particular incident where there was some of those prisoners were up on the roof of one particular hut, and this Commandant Galway was telling them to go down, get them, surrender, get down or you'll be shot. And they didn't go down, and there was one of them, he shot one of them down off the roof. In the Hare Park,
and the burning of the huts.
Yes, the huts. They tried to set fire to all the huts, and they had tunnels. It was covered later after that. A lot of tunneling done, and they were nearly completed, but outside the outer boundary of the huts.
And did any of them actually? They were never finished, so they were never used.
No, they were there up to only a short few years ago, and then they decided they would knock them down.
That's all interesting because, do you know, you have many stories coming from all sides about what it was like, and De Valera at the time, he was quite adamant about making sure that that there would be no threat to the country at that time. So he rounded them all up and put them in there.
Yeah, sure. That was the famous time with Charlie High and that Captain O'Leary. Do you remember the gun running thing? Yes.
Oh, well, you're back to the 1960s
again. Yes, sorry, yes.
Well, do you remember the blue shirts then?
I would vaguely remember them. That was kind of more of a political thing than anything else. It was like the farmers and the regulars then at that time. You know, I would never remember a lot about the blue shirts.
Did your father support them then?
No, he was a Free State, you see. Yeah. A Free State.
So he was very much on the other side.
But he often spoke about the troubled times, the rebellion in Dublin that time, you know, with Collins and all those guys, you know, he used to speak a lot about that.
And what platoon was he in?
God, I don't know, and I'll show you the medal, there now, but I can show you.
Did he fight in 1916?
No, he got wounded somewhere in some kind of an exercise or something, and was he wasn't actually in the raising as such, you know. No, it doesn't matter about the bed line, but I could give you the details of what he was in or something.
I would be very interested, yeah. So there is an inscription on the back of it, yeah.
It's Patrick Lynch, C Company, 2nd Battalion, Dublin Brigade, 1917 to 1921.
Indeed. Well, so that marks the man's position, indeed. Yeah,
yeah.
So, what did he talk about?
Could he
talk about
he went off the atrocities
But did he talk about any of the how people were affected by it, or how people? You know, kind of stood up at the time to British rule and wanted to succeed in this battle. I mean, how at the time the 1916 rising, you see, didn't seem to have as much enthusiasm as later when they were executed.
Well, that's true. No, he never spoke a lot about that. He used to speak a lot about the insurrection, right? He used to talk a lot about that, you know, about Michael Collins and driving him around Dublin and being shot at several times. And he used to point out where the place there in Island Bridge, where overlooking McKee Barracks there, and there was a particular window there where Collins used to have his touts or his scouts, and he'd be watching every movement in the barracks in McKee, you know, of the movement of troops or whatever was going on in McKee.
During the Civil War?
And
your dad was driving him around?
Yes, he did. Driving him around Dublin, yes. He also spoke about Mount Street Bridge. They were attacked on Mount Street Bridge, and they weren't in Schlievenamon, they were in a Crosley tender at the time, and they were shot at, and I know that kind of discipline led to believe Thomas was to drive on there, Lynch, and they drove back, and he just tried to go back to Barracks. He said, we were lucky there, Lynch. That's what he's supposed to have said to him anyhow.
So you obviously a very brave man. He didn't worry too much.
You were a driver, and you were just told, you go here, you go there, you do this or you do that. You know, you didn't have any options. Like, it was no use then, I won't go this, I won't go here, I won't do that. That was a thing, yeah.
They were interesting times,
and
all right.
He often tells the series Eskin Childers. Was it Eskin Childers? Was it executor? Was it? Yeah.
No, it was his father.
He drove him to his execution. Yeah.
Eskin Childers' father drove to his execution.
Drove him. Now in convoy, like not by himself. In a convoy, but he was.
And what about your poor mother? Was she taken by the whole thing?
I suppose you just went with the film.
She was Beatrice who?
Beatrice Ferry, would you believe? Ferry.
F-E-R-R-Y.
Yes, yeah.
Dublin,
yes, yeah.
And then they moved out here to Logstown. Is that where they came back, or did you?
No, when we, in 1940, fate is a funny thing. When we had to evacuate the Curragh, we were Renans below, who were the auctioneers and valuers and house estate agents. They came up with a house in Maddenstown, over where Marguerite lives.
In the Curragh.
French House was the name of this big, it was a huge big mansion of a place, much, much too big for us, but we had no option at the time. But Brennan, who was the agent for my father, not for my father, and lots of people that came out here, then some guy, a horse trainer, sought refuge around here, and he was looking for a big place to train his horses. And Bazzy Brennan came to my father and mother and told him that he had a nice place in Kilcullen if they'd like to have a look and see. And that was down where the Gilly is now, you know the...
Millrace.
Right. And that was our faith, and my father and mother cycled out here and liked what they saw, and so we came to be here.
Was Logstown built at that
time? No.
Moved up to Logstown.
Yeah, and then I suppose I should have said this earlier. After the emergency, There was an option then, if you wanted to move back to the Curragh, you could. And we were offered a nice house on the Curragh, and they went up and looked at it, and they decided to go back. And we were there then, and I met Dolly, my wife, here while we were in Kilcullen, and went back to the Curragh and married her in 1948. Mm-hmm. And we lived where Glennon is now, you know.
On the hillside.
On the hillside, yes, yeah. You know, Glennon, yes.
Yes, yes, hillside, Kilcullen.
Kilcullen.
And these houses here were built?
And in the 52, 53 or something, yes.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And all you people moved up, including Pat's mother and father?
Pat's mother and father, yes. We all moved
and
up.
And were these houses county council
county
houses?
County council houses, yes.
And they were given to the people who came out of the Curragh?
Well, not particularly. Like, you know, yeah, there was a kind of, not a means test, but it was a, what would I say, they came and looked at where you were and,
and they decided
who was entitled to what. Yeah, yes, yeah. And that's the way that we get to be here. Then. Yeah.
And growing up in, you grew up in the Curragh.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
What was we spoke earlier about this now, but the atmosphere, the other families and
well,
that.
It was great because you see, as you know, there are seven barracks on the Curragh. You know, they're all named after the leaders, you know, Pierce, McDonough, McDermott, Kent, Connolly, Plunkett, all those. And each one had their own kind of own little area, if you know what I mean. You know,
community type.
Yeah, community type thing. And it was great because for what no one else had, we had, there were two cinemas, like, and there was an army bakery, and there was a swimming pool, and there was all kinds of ball alleys, and each barracks had their own playing pitches and the rest like that.
And did you go to the vocational school there?
No, I went, when I finished at the Curragh, I went to Newbridge.
And to the
technical school in Newbridge.
Oh, I see.
And there, yeah. And I went from there, then from when I finished in Newbridge, I went on into Naas.
And who was the primary teacher in the Curragh when you... You were in the primary there, right?
Mr. Sheen. Mr. Sheen.
And he also went who was it?
There was a Mr. Lee Hand there. He was a Kerryman. He wasn't nice.
So they were the
national. They were the national, yeah.
So you went primary. to the vocational, the technical
yes, yes.
In
Newbridge. Yes, yes.
And what did you do then? You went to the barracks in
Naas,
or the tech in
Naas? Oh, the old barracks was the tech in Naas at the time, yes.
Why did you move from Newbridge?
Because, they say, you only done 2 years, and then there was no machinery class in Newbridge. You see, I had done 2 years there, and you graduated then to go into Naas, where it was the upper kind of an echelon as regards mechanics and all that kind of stuff, where they had then the lathes and milling machines or whatever.
They had a motor car machinery engineering
in Naas.
In Naas, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Very interesting. Yes. And so your career was carved out, really. I mean, that's...
Well, I suppose it was.
Did you always love cars, like, or engines?
Well, I suppose my father, in the workshops, we would be often in and out of it, and I suppose we grew up with cars, and we all these little pedal motor by our cars at the time, this lens that you got in and had two pedals, and they kind of grew up with it at that stage.
And
my other brother now, Morrissey, went to the Air Force, and he became very successful in the British Air Force.
Just before I forget to ask you, your mother Beatrice, was she in Comanamon?
No. But funny thing, my father's mother, she was big into Comanamon, and one of the battles, Sackville Street, was it? Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was. I don't know if she was a pedestrian or what she was doing, but she was wounded or injured in some kind of a scuffle there in Sackville Street.
Yeah, well, that was O'Connell Street. That was the main battle
in front of the GPO. Yeah, that's right, yes. Yeah.
And she was wounded
She
there.
Was wounded in my father's mother, yes. Yeah. And there was a book that was published at that time, and my brother of the North got it, and he gave it to someone. I never come back, but she was cited in it in that particular book.
She was cited in the book.
And being this run of battle, and she was injured at Elizabeth Lynch.
And I suppose, was she helping Well, you never told.
And as I say, the brother had this book, and it was only a few editions of it. It was a rare thing, and he gave it to someone, and you know,
disappeared.
Like everything gets lost. Yeah. You mind that, Med?
Yeah.
But they are memories, mementos of that time, and I know that medal is indeed very precious.
It's with the ribbon.
Yeah.
And there's not too many medals, Pat.
No, that's fairly rare, I believe. Yes.
What about the, you know, having that kind of a background and you know, kind of growing up with military people around you all the time, did that kind of instill in you? Were you into soldiering? Like, were you kind of a person that would?
Well, other than the fact, you know, that had I qualified in Ballydonald, like I would have qualified as an aero mechanic or an aero fitter, would you? But just wasn't to be. But having said that, now when I went to work in the Curragh, it was totally army orientated, and it still is, like, and I would still have a lot of friends, and I'm invited back to all the social occasions and the Curragh over the years.
But the disciplinary
lifestyle. Well, it's like you know, you get it and you get it goes into your bones and you don't forget, and I'd always think about I'm here on my own now, but the fact that you were there in the army, you made your own bed and you're done, you had to keep your own area clean and you've done all this bits and pieces, and it still rubs off, like I've no problem
now.
Yes, now I have no problem, like as a girl doing a bit of cooking or making my own bed or changing the sheets or, you know, all that kind of a thing, and the spit and polish then, you know. Yes.
And up early in the morning and to bed early at night.
Yes.
But the sporting, sport played a big part in your life.
Huge part, yes. Absolutely huge now. As I remember now, Anthony's father, Jim, he kind of initiated me back in 1943, you know. And as I say, he was the leading light on the county board here. And he was the kind of godfather for us all growing up with the years, you know, and he would be some man to give you a clip in the ear and tell you that you're doing wrong. Yes, your father.
Can I ask you just one question there, Pat? I know it's a bit of Morris asked me about where my grandfather would have got the flour. Would he have got it from the miller next door, or where would he put the bakery? Would you know?
No, Udlums. I can remember, because I had great affinity with the O'Connors. I remember my mother, and I remember those being married, like, and working in the bakery and working in the pub and whatever.
That's
but
nice,
I can remember the Udlums lorry used to come, and at that time in the old loft where Brennan's office is now, there was a beam coming out, you know, with a pulley in, and the lorry had run, you'd hook up the bag of flour and you'd pull it up and some other pull it in. And that was the flour that was used in the bakery.
You have regret coming to Kilcullen, Pat?
No, never any regrets. No, I loved it. And
you were born in 1924. 25. So you would have, as a child, you would have remembered the economic war.
Tell me about it, dreadful. It was dreadful.
What are your young memories?
One of the abiding memory is the brown bread, we used to call it. It was a concoction of bran and flour, ordinary flour, and every conceivable kind of a bit of flour. It was dreadful. And it used to come in days in a loaf, a 2-pound loaf, you know. And your wife would be eating mud. It was absolutely dreadful. And then, of course, the rationing was a dreadful thing too. Like the sugar was rationed, the tea was rationed, the butter was rationed. Most things were rationed. You know, people used to improvise at that stage. Mm. And I remember the great one was people used to kind of carrot tea and parsnip tea. They used to dry out a carrot and grate it down to a very fine paste or something. This was improvised tea. It was absolutely dreadful. Yeah.
This was the end of the 30s now, the beginning of
the Second World War.
And those years were apart from the rationing that was going on, there was no cars, because there was no petrol. Petrol was rationed.
There was no cars on the road at all. No, none at all, except a doctor now or a priest. They would have a limited petrol allowance.
But do you remember people going back to horse travel, you know, horse and traps, oh, horse and cars.
Oh, indeed I do. Well, yes, oh, indeed I do. Sure, it was. I remember one particular incident. We were in a final in 1945, and we were playing a team from North Kildare, Kappa, and the match was in Clane. And we were back living on the Corrida, and I remember cycling out to Kilcullen here. There was three Hackney cars, if you know what they're in there, which is down in Killarney, Galerna. Three Hackney cars, and it loaded the whole team, and not supporters, supporters went on bikes. And we went there from, we went from here to Clane. And won in the final, and we came back to Lawler's and had something to eat, and then we came back to on the Hackney cars. And I remember it was in November actually, and just up the road at McDonald's Hill, I remember one of the horses slipped coming down the hill, and there was lads throwing left, right, and center all over the place. But I wasn't drinking at them, but all the had there, and lads would have had several pints, like, you know, and were flittered all over the road. That was in 45, but that was the only mode of transport then. Yes, that was in 45. Yeah.
Okay.
And the famous one that went on was the Micheál Ó Derby doing the commentary.
The commentary at the time,
and
yeah.
The famous Dan O'Keefe from Strand Street Tralee. That was a great stain of it. You remember Strand Street? I don't know where Strand Street is.
Right, yeah.
Dan O'Keefe was the goalman. And in goal, the famous Dan O'Keefe from Strand Street Tralee. This would ring out every match that was being played.
But you probably went in the ghost train up to Dublin to watch the match. Or how would you travel to Dublin from
cycle.
Here? Just cycle.
Cycle. Cycle, no problem.
So were you, yes, because of the I suppose, the cheap way of getting around at the time as well.
But it was the only means, actually, like, no one had cars at that time, you know.
Talking about the cycling, Mr. Burney and my father, they race?
They raced in Crow Park. There was
in Phoenix Park, wasn't
it? In Crow Park, though. There was a cinder track in Crow Park, yes,
right.
Yes.
So they would cycle? From Kilcullen to
Dublin
and set up their
racing gear, that's right.
In Phoenix Park.
That's
And then get on the bicycle and cycle.
That is true, yeah. That is really true. And 1947, I think Kildare got into Leinster and were playing Leaks and
but before you tell me that now, your father, he was on the bike cycling around a center track in Crow Park?
No, Nessa's
father.
Oh, your
father. My father and Bernie Tom Burney of Burney Saddery, which is a very famous saddery here in Kilcullen.
Four generations.
And they export to America and everywhere.
Germany, anywhere.
And they were cycling around Crow Park. What year? Tarleton Games, 1928.
Yes, it would have been that time, yeah.
And how well did he do?
I think Tom Burney did very well. My father would have been only trailing behind, but I remember Tom Burney. Yeah. We have a big photograph of him up in our Heritage Centre. It's just the fact that they would actually cycle to Dublin, then put on whatever wheels they'd be racing in, then change them after the race and cycle back.
Yeah. Oh, what kind of cycling did you do yourself, Pat?
Other than the fact that you cycled everywhere, but in the summer particularly, I remember that 1947, Kildare were playing Laois, and the famous Tommy Murphy, who was in dispute or was injured anyhow, and the Laois people didn't want to play it, and Kildare wanted to play it, and there was a bit of confusion, anyway, but the news broke on the morning that the match was on. And my brother-in-law, Micheál, who lives down there, we went to 9:30 and got on our bikes and cycled to Crow Park, and with a famous little restaurant on the quays, Kitty O'Shea, as you went in there, and with 2 shillings, you got all the brown bread you could eat and all the tea you could drink, and cycled on to Crow Park and saw our match and got on our bikes and arrived back here at 10 or 11 o'clock at night, not a bother on us. That was a regular occurrence. Yeah, it was a regular thing. Mm.
And in those days, the roads couldn't have been good.
Oh,
and
sure,
the bikes were worse.
And the bikes were driving. You'd be always praying. You always brought a spare tube and a repair outfit was the big thing. Yeah, and the tire you would have to was you brought 2 spoons, which are 2 forks, to lever the tire off if you got punctured. And then you had your little box about that size with your patch and your They're a bit of solution.
Oh, what kind, was it a rally bike or?
Oh God, a Rudge and Rally were the big ones at the time.
The High Nellies.
The High Nellies. There was no three-speed, and there was no dynamos. There was no nothing. No hubs. It was not just the ordinary fixed wheel. Yeah, fixed wheel. And that was regular occurrence. Yeah.
And tell me about the roads then.
Should it be dreadful from the road? From here to Dublin at the time, it was like a snake track. You know, it was nothing but twists and turns and hills and the whole thing and that. Yeah.
How long would it have taken you?
Sure, it'd take hours. About 3 hours it'd take us to go up. Yeah, 3 hours when you'd be cycling along, hoping you wouldn't get a puncture. But when I suppose I was lucky when I was in Baldonnell, because there was a lot of my classmates who would have been from Dublin, you know, and they would always be allowed out at 12:30 on a Sunday, and be back before 23:59 hours on a Sunday night. And I was lucky then, and I had a bike behind Nelly, my mother, God have mercy, give me. And I would leave Baldonnell there at 12:30 on a Saturday, and I'd arrive home about 3-4 o'clock here. And sure, it was great then to get home. You had to wear your uniform home, and you had your civic. You were a new man, they say. You went down the town and step into your chin. And then come Sunday night, 6 o'clock, get on that bike, cycle back, and you'd be trying to make it by you. 23:59 hours, which was 12 o'clock. You had to be in by 12, and that was the chore then. That was regular. That was norm, accepted. Like you know the way you done it, or you sat there all over the weekend.
Wasn't that fantastic?
It's not something I would have been aware of. And you just took it as a matter of course.
It was never a thing. And I remember, if I may say this at the time. When I was at the lower end of the scale, when I went in, I was on 3 and 2 pence a week. That was my wage, just because I went in at the lower end, you know. And at that time, we were confined to the camp, the hostel, as we used to call it. We weren't allowed up camp. We weren't allowed to mix with any of the regulars, you see. And
was there a pecking order like that?
Well, the apprentices were kept away from the ordinary. Except
really? You couldn't go near them?
No, except during the day when we'd be at classes or we're working in the hangars or anything like that. But I can remember, and the money, you think you'd never, a fellow used to go around at night and he goes in and said 2 bars of chocolate, 2 cream buns or gourd cake or whatever. There was one fellow designated to go to the canteen. Like, but I can remember sitting there, I used to keep 4 pence. No matter what else I spent, and I used to go into a little shop in Naas coming by, and Fox's Lazier Mints, you got a quarter of a pound for 4 pence, and I'd bring them home to my mother, and that was my spending for the week. Of course, then going back, Jim, I spent all my time in the breaker with Jim, and he was a terrible go by altogether. He used to do a dreadful thing, so he gets you into terrible trouble.
Set job.
Yeah, set job. But anyhow, they used to make this little small brown cake. This little small brown cake.
Well, now, you're helping me here, Pat. Yeah. Because what sort of bread did he make in the bakery? You're saying this brown bread.
Brown bread, yes.
Yeah.
That was a little small pan, as we would call it now. Yeah. But then there was the bigger one, and then there was the loaf.
The batch loaf. So that was all he made.
That was all, yeah.
But what was he doing on you down there?
Oh, sure, he used to do dreadful things. I used to go around with the van, I'm sure. Most of grateful, and I could tell you a lot about him.
Yeah.
Ah, no, it was never anything. It was all fun and games. I remember he was a divot, mother of Jesus, Mary and Joseph. We'd be all up at the town. At that time, there'd be nothing in the town here. And the night would be no picture. We'd all congregate at Burns Corners at the hideout.
Yes.
And your father in the middle of it, and there'd be all kinds of blackguard going on. But then we'd all decide to come home, and there was a little shop, the Credit Union, now Casey's lived in it, you see. And we'd be all coming down the town laughing and playing. And the next year, a man would get to the door, and he'd hit this knocker a bang, and then he'd run, and see, we'd be all left. And it was a poor old man, he was about 6'6" or 6'7", you see. And the poor old David would have come to the door, and of course, there'd be no one there. But your man would be down the bottom of the bridge laughing up at us, you see. It was one of his pranks. That was a regular one. We never got used to doing it. Yeah,
he was always
there.
But you had the clubs, going back there to what you were saying about Dan Brennan's, where you remember you had your social club.
Yeah.
When then you were into the snooker and the billiards as well, weren't you, Pat?
Oh yeah, we all played. Yeah. We all played. Your father was semi-professional. Your father was a billiard. Yeah.
But did that move? When did that move up to here then, up to the
whenever the tennis club was built back in the 60s or 70s or there, 80s,
and it's
maybe
still there today.
Yeah.
So these were the fun and games you got up to.
Massage.
What are the sort of fun and games that you get up to, Pat? Pat has a great way of sayings, and unfortunately they only come when something happens. He's the greatest man for these old type of sayings. But unfortunately I haven't heard any of them. You've been very good.
I wasn't thinking of one, and then I said, God, I must remember that now I'm talking to Nessa. I was thinking of one the other day, Nessa. And maybe I thought, and I said, oh yeah, it came up somewhere, and there was this fellow saying, it can't be done. But it's good that someone said it couldn't be done. But he with a grin replied, maybe it couldn't, but here was one who will not say no till he's tried.
and you know, these were the old Shanuckles.
That's right, yeah.
And you know, you'd hear them a lot in Irish, but you've heard them in English.
In English, And every now and then I come and I tell Nessa that one.
No, it's just that I've often said to Patty, should write them down, they only come
the occasion, and you'd be down the fields, and something would turn up, and you would think of it then.
Where would you have heard them from? All you know, from the farmers, is it? And
I suppose
from different people,
and man, and another famous one. Can I say this one too?
Yes.
Strike a nail right by. Have you ever heard that one?
No, go ahead and say it.
Strike a nail right by. Strike it on the head. Strike with all your might by while the iron's red. When you work to do by's, do it with a will. Those who reach the top by's, first must climb the hill. Though you stumble off by's, never be downcast. Try and try again by's, you'll get on at last.
I've heard that before. Yeah. I've heard it in Tipperary and I've heard it in Kerry. That's one that got around all right. But isn't it interesting,
But I've often here at night now with Nessa. I'm sure poor Nessa has her bad moments too, and I do, and I'd be often here at night and I'd be singing to myself and reciting and a couple of fuckles here and a couple of fuckles there. And
God, when you think about it, Nessa, you recently lost your partner. And you've lost your partner.
Yes.
To Pat.
Nessa's was infinitely worse than mine, because Dolly had lived a full life. She was 87. Poor Pat was only in his late 50s.
And I asked Nessa before, but tell me about Dolly. How did you meet?
Oh, I suppose
was it at the local dance?
The usual thing here, the Kilcullen Carnival back again in the 50s and 60s.
It was a fundraiser for the church.
Church, yes. And it was the be all and end all. It started on a Friday night and went on till the following Monday week or something. But it was the be all and end all of the county. Kilcullen Carnival was the place to be.
And
the marquee dancing, yes.
What are the bands? Some of the bands.
Jim Della Hunt, and there was Johnny Butler, and there was Jimmy Dunney, and all the top bands. Yeah.
Yeah. But you met Dolly there,
didn't you? Dolly at the dance. But you know, the staying used to go around, you'd be at Mass on the morning. Oh, there's Mickey Joe, or there's Annabelle. Oh, they're home for the holidays, they're home for the carnival. You know, the people that went to England would come on home in droves for the carnival in Kilcullen. That was the big one.
Really? So that was. And did you have a carnival queen? Did you choose the carnival?
No, not later. Just simply dancing.
It was when the priests were very much so involved. There was a parish committee of which the priest was the chairman. So you didn't misbehave, as you can imagine. Was it the same carnival people that came? Was it the Curries?
The Curries, the amusements.
Many years were they coming?
Sure, they were coming for years, too. And the Vic Loving show, there was a road show. Vic Loving, she was a famous road show.
Yeah, that was a travelling...
Travelling road show.
Did you call them fit-ups?
Is that right?
The road shows
we used to call them, yes.
And did they set up their own tent,
they'd be down in the cinema. Down in the town hall, yeah. But the amusement people, they would set up in the carnival.
The swinging boats and the chair planes and the bumpers, as we used to call them. And then in the later years, you had the big wheel. But it was this particular family, the Curry family, who actually, I'd say it must have been 20 years they were coming out. It was the same time every year that they came. And this is what Pat is saying, that people came home knew that the carnival would be on at that particular time, so they arranged their holidays coming home from England because it was something that would be on. And then there was this marquee dancing, and that was on every night.
Would that be a kind of a reunion, you know, of families that immigrated?
Absolutely. That was the greatest reunion annual. It was like, we would compare it to Puck Fair. People would, we would say the same about the Kilcullen Carnival. Everyone that could come home would come home, and they would organise from year to year when they're going back. They'd want to know when the dates of the carnival next year.
And did it attract hawkers on the streets and all
no,
of that?
No, never had any of that at all. No, never.
When it was run by the parish priest, I suppose. But you had a bazaar, I suppose, did you?
When you call a bazaar, Maurice,
a kind of a place where things would be, secondhand items would be sold.
You had the big wheel where you bought your tickets.
The rifle range, and there was all these kind of.
And some of the prize, but usually the curries, I think the actual carnival beat would have bought the prizes. Like, and nowadays you'd be putting in the prizes, like you'd be gathering them from other people, but in those days they were bought, and like everybody, you'd have the tea sets and. All those sort of prizes, and people don't win. They were great prizes to win because people just didn't have them.
Yeah. No, and did circuses come this way?
Circuses, yes. Funny thing, Nessa would know her as being the Sheep Green, which is just halfway down the hill there.
Yeah.
It's just how Nessa went down the Sheep Green. The circus, Duffy Circus, used to come, and Fawcett Circus would come, and they would set up on the Sheep Green down there.
No, Pat, that's supposed to be launching because I wouldn't remember that now.
They say you were only 50, they made you.
Oh, that's bad.
So it's more than 50 years ago they were here.
Yes, the Sheep Green.
Who were they? The Duffys?
Duffys and Fawcetts.
And Fawcetts.
Fawcetts, they were the two ones.
Chipperfields ever come
Chipper,
here?
No, never had Chipperfield. They were the two, the dominant ones, Duffys and Fawcetts.
And they're on the go a long time.
I think Duffys are gone, but Fawcetts are still on, still somewhere around. I think down around Mount Rath or somewhere down there. They have their winter camp. Or
and what kind of performers were in the? Was it the normal horses? But did they have?
They would have the elephants and the lions, and they'd have those in the cage, and the trapeze artists, and of course the clowns was the big thing, and. Fella would run around, you know, the clowns, and he'd jump into the crowd, and kids would be bawling, and he'd be climbing up ropes and everything. And,
and the trapeze.
Great. The fire eater, that's right, yeah. Exactly. Then, of course, you had the band, which was the great thing, you know. That's it.
It really brings back all those days.
I would remember casting back to the Curra. And they used to, Duffys, and Duffys were the dominant ones. They were absolutely huge, you know, and they would come and they set up in the market square, that one at the bottom where O'Donnell is now, but huge marquee. But the school, and you know, when I think back now, and there were 600 people, men and boys, in the schools on the Curra at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And when they would arrive, maybe on the Friday or Thursday night, and then the catch penny was that would parade all the elephants and the kangaroos and all this by the school during the day, and the band would be playing, of course, every the minute you got out at 3 o'clock or down to the circus. It was great to see the elephants. And I remember the famous Gene Autry. Did you ever him? I remember him.
I do indeed.
He visited the Curra one time too.
Great cowboy.
That's true. And I remember a pal of mine, we'd nothing at the time, but a pal of mine saw a player, 10 players, an empty box in the shore there. And he went over and got a butt of a pencil, and he got Gene Archery's.
The carton of 10. Cigarette carton. Players.
And
he picked it up and got
his autograph and this.
And what was he doing in the Curra?
I think he was just in Ireland at the time, and maybe, I don't know, never know, but he just paid a visitation here. Yeah.
We also, did you ever tell him about Mongrel Park?
Oh, indeed I do, yes.
We had a type of dog racing, but it was for mongrels, and It was Jim Byrne that started it. I don't know how many years it went, but I mean, my memory of it has been Princess Grace, who came to visit Ireland, and she was coming from the Japanese Gardens across to Wicklow, and there was a big sign up, Mongrel Park welcomes Princess Grace.
That's right, that was a real catchpenny one too, yes.
Yeah. How long did that last?
It went for 5 or 6 years, because we were the first in Kilcullen. It was in association with the Boxing Club, a fundraiser for the Boxing Club. And of course, it became very, very successful. So much so that there could be 20 bookies there on a Sunday, you know, at the Mungar Park race. Yeah.
Was there?
20, yes. Yeah, and I remember even Galway would be on the Saturday, it was Saturday then, but the bookies would leave Galway and come straight to Kilcullen here on the Sunday to the Dog and the Terrier racing. Yeah. It was that big, huge. But then it became...
And what went on? Terrier racing.
Yeah.
Oh, well, in a circle or...
straight 100 yards.
With a hair?
With an artificial hair. Something the same as a dog track, only it was straight, 100 yards
and
dash, as they would say. Yes. And there'd be more, they'd be all down, and they would be all graded from according to your height. You'd have sheep dogs, and you'd have half grey hounds, and you'd have whippets, and you'd have little Pekingese yokes.
And
it was all graded, yes. Yeah. But it became so popular then that it sprung up all over the country, then, well, all over Kildare, particularly. You know.
And did it start here?
Yes, it started here.
And who started it now?
This man, Junior J.J. Byrne, where Donnelly's arm is now, he saw it somewhere and decided we'd go for this one. You know,
Morris, have you ever heard of Donnelly's arm?
No.
Would you explain to him, Pat?
And Donnelly's hollow. Remember a Donnelly's hollow?
Yeah, well, just
no, you
to
see,
Morris,
when you're a blowing, it is hard. Yeah. Could you tell me what a Donnelly's hollow?
This was the famous pugilist, Donnelly's hollow. Now, for dates, and I should know, but he was a famous pugilist anyhow. And he trained out here in Calverstown. I think he was born in Dublin or somewhere. But this was bare-knuckle kind of job, you know? So... he wanted to, there was an Englishman, Cooper, Donnelly and Cooper, that's how the name came about. So they were in dispute who was the champion. So they decided that there was only one way to settle this. And this was in a fight. And this fight took place out in Donnelly's Hollow, about 3 miles back towards the Curragh there. There's a big, it's like an amphitheatre there, with this monument down at the bottom of it, yeah. And this is where this bare knuckle fight took place back in the 1800s or something, anyhow. But our man Donnelly bet Cooper anyhow, and it's still there to be seen, where on his way out of the ring after the ring, he went up this hill, and his footprints are still on the hill up there. You go up there in the sun, you see all the people wading up through those footprints up over the hill where he went.
Very famous fight.
Very famous, yeah.
And you reenacted it then?
We reenacted it in Tostil, then the boxing club again. We reenacted it with ourselves and the football club. We all got together and put on this pageant.
So there was always a tradition down this way for boxing.
Boxing,
so.
Yes, there would have been, yes. Yeah.
But this particular arm, Morris... his body was, I think, given to what happened?
College of Surgeons in Belfast.
Yes, in Belfast, and his arm was obviously removed.
Yeah.
And it eventually came back to the hideout, and it's like a skeleton arm.
Yeah.
And I actually, it's going. I'm bringing it over to a place over in Newbridge tonight that they're doing a talk on it. But it's Dan Donnelly's arm now. It was all restored. It's owned by the Byrne family. Yeah. It was in the hideout, but they sold the hideout a few years ago. And they kept it at home.
Mm.
But since that, there was an Irish boxing exhibition, the Fighting Irish in New York, the Arts Centre, Irish Arts Centre in New York. And the man who was organising it asked the Byrne family, could he have it for it, which they did. They brought it over to him, and it went from there to Boston for another exhibition. Now it's back home, and I think it's going up. I think Barry McGuigan is having some sort of a thing coming up, and it's going up for that exhibition up the north. So that's a little bit of
Is it any way different to your?
It's longer. It's a bow. He was supposed to have
supposed to be
the picture shows that his arms were nearly down to his knees.
You know, the those breeches that time, they were laced up to around here. You know, know, and he was reputed to be able to reach down to this,
the bridge. The bridge.
He was able to lace the bridge of the knee, but
so long. So long.
Oh, I see. And yeah. So that he had a good stretch then.
Well,
and,
that's
yeah. Do you know, it's been incredible to come here and to recall. I mean, you could go on, I'd say, for hours.
And Pat is marvellous. Pat's yeah,
indeed, indeed,
really.
I'm not.
Pat, I'm just afraid now, you want to be very careful in that, Pat.
I asked someone about it. I asked...
this is the lovely medal,
I asked your man, what had gone out the Nace, or the Chapel Road, there's Travers, you know, yes. I was telling Dress about it, and I was just asking him, like, if there were anywhere you could get it, kind of...
Yeah, well, repair. Put that back into the green box.
Yeah. Can I just put maybe the last question to you? Did you ever think that in your family you had your grandfather in the British Army and your father in the Irish Republican Army fighting the British?
Yes, yes.
That was a kind of a conflict, wasn't it?
Wasn't it? Be a bit of a conflict, all right. Yes, yeah.
Well, it's already mentioned. Did you know your grandfather? Or
I did. Well, yes, yeah. And he had a lot of memorabilia. I think he was injured in Mesopotamia. He used to talk about this.
Oh, did he go out and fight in the First World War?
No, he did.
So you have your grandfather's medals, maybe, too?
Yes, Laura has those. Yes, yes, they have those. But I know he used to always talk about when he was injured in Mesopotamia. We, as kids, this Mesopotamia was a great word to be able to say. We didn't know where it was or what it was. It was great to be able to say my grandfather fought in Mesopotamia.
Well, Patrick. Your grandfather's name is what? Was he Patrick as
Patrick
well?
Patrick too. Yeah.
So he was Patrick, your father was Patrick, and then you were Patrick. Yeah. And Porrick then, of course, is your son. So you've kept the name in the family.
But there was dreadful confusion when I went to the army. I never knew it was, I suppose I did, but confirmation, you know, but I was christened Edward Patrick, you see. So when I went to join the army, then there was Patrick Lynch and there was Patrick Lynch, and which was the father was being quoted like as doing something, and I was quoted as something to Patrick. So when I went to Valdana, I had to be down as Edward Patrick. That's I had to differentiate between the two Patricks then. So Edward Patrick, and to this day I'm getting Edward Patrick Lynch, and no one ever knew. Like.
And can I say Patrick Lynch is sitting down here beside the fire and talking to you with Nessa today. It was just great, and thank you, Nessa, for bringing me here.
It's a pleasure for me, because I've been talking to Papa, because I know his memories, and as Pat said to you there, we go back a long way, both families, you know, we've been through a lot of the wars together, and we support each other, and that's what I will always talk about the community in Kilcullen.
Nessa Dunley O'Connell
just a quickie before I go, the association was that Pat was born just 2 doors down from where we are now, and he grew up with my lads, and they were all very, very great, and Pat became very successful in the garage business, as you know. And I remember when I retired, I was saying, I said, God, I wonder what I'm going to do now, you know, and I was up in the garage talking to Pat one day, and I said, I'm finished next week. You're not, he says, I have a job for you. And then he used to boast in, when he introduced me to this fellow, was 44 years on the Corps, and he never worked a day until he came to me.
Thank you, Pat. Thank you.
Thanks, Pat.